My guest today, Dinah Johnstone, is an American journalist based in Paris, whose writing is focused primarily on European politics and Western foreign policy, which is why whoever is seeking the White House is of interest to her. She was active in the movement against the Vietnam War, organizing the first international contacts between American citizens and Vietnamese representatives. Most of her adult life has been spent in France, Germany, and Italy, from where she worked from 1979 to 1990 as the European editor of the U.S. Weekly In These Times, and she was also press officer of the Green Group in the European Parliament from 1990 to 1996. Dinah Johnstone has previously published two books, The Politics of Euromissiles, Europe's Role in America's World in 1985, and Fool's Crusade, Yugoslavia, NATO, and Western Delusions in 2003, which challenged the official narrative of the Bosnian War and the destruction of Yugoslavia. She's a frequent contributor to Counterpunch, which has just published her latest book, a critical examination of Hillary Clinton, titled Queen of Chaos, and that's what and who we're going to talk about today. I've interviewed Dinah twice before, once from her apartment in Paris, so it's nice to have her back on the phone. Welcome, Dinah Johnstone, back to Takes on the World.
Well, it's nice to talk to you again, Jeffrey.
And I haven't seen you in a long time, but I'll look forward to that one of these days again. Let's start with asking you, why did you decide to coronate Hillary Clinton as Queen of Chaos?
Well, because of the chaos. I should insist that in that title, the chaos is more important than the queen. This is essentially a book about the ideological and so on background of U.S. foreign policy, and Hillary is simply a prime example of everything that's wrong. She's not alone in that, but she is sort of on track to be president because she's got all the money behind her. She has the sort of she's the establishment, the war party candidate. And, of course, the result of that policy is the chaos that's in the title.
Well, go on, yes.
No, I'm waiting for
another question. I was going to say, it's interesting that chaos is one of the prime goals of some of the neocons, like Michael Ledeen once wrote about that chaos is what we benefit from. And they've certainly done a long way in creating it. And as you point out, and I've mentioned on my program before, her connection to these neocons, and which I would really like to talk about, and you write about in the book, is really something most people aren't aware of. So perhaps you go into that.
Well, the neocons are just there constantly behind the scenes, not always behind the scenes. Sometimes they're very conspicuous, as in Ukraine, where the coup d'état was partly engineered by Victoria Nuland, who is a prime neocon and very close to Hillary Clinton, was her spokesperson. But the thing is that they share the same basic suppositions, starting with the idea that American power can do anything in the world. And this supposition is already, they say that Hillary is supposed to be pragmatic rather than ideological, but that is an ideology. That's an ideology because it's a fantasy, because it's an illusion, that United States power can do anything. It can remake countries and all on our own image and so on, which simply is demonstrably not true. And this is a supposition of the neocons, who also have the notion that this power to change the world can also change the world to the benefit of Israel. And Hillary seems to have the same idea, or at least she says so, because of all the money that she gets from Haim Saban and so on. So they are all united in using U.S. power to benefit, in fact, Israel's position in the Middle East, which is why, of course, they have systematically destroyed well, at least two countries, Iraq and Libya, and are busily trying to destroy Syria at the present time, because those were countries that were friendly to the Palestinians, and as such, simply must be removed from the scene. And that's what we're seeing right now. And, of course, Hillary has been a very ardent backer of all of these, especially of the present destruction in Syria.
Well, I know, actually, she was much more out front about going into Libya, intervening in Libya, than was President Obama. The French and British were hot to do that, but Hillary was like sitting on her horse, kind of leading the American charge, and crowed about that after Gaddafi had been killed. She made some statement about we came, we saw him, he was killed, or something like that. It was pretty gross, considering she was speaking about the killing of a head of state who had never attacked the United States.
Well, there have been some articles recently. Robert Scheer article in particular, which says, reports that, and it's probably been in other parts of the press that I've missed, that in fact her advisors, including Sidney Blumenthal and Jake Sullivan, thought she could use her advocacy of the Libya disaster to frame herself as a perfect candidate for presidency with a sort of Clinton doctrine, and that the remark that she made, which is absolutely scandalous, was perhaps practiced ahead of time, because some of her advisors said she must make a statement the moment Gaddafi is killed, so that she will go down in history as behind this atrocity, and this should set her up to be president. Of course, the fact is that the popular reaction to that gross statement has not been as positive as her advisors probably hoped, and it's something that she doesn't refer to anymore. It doesn't refer to in her book Hard Choices, for instance. She talks about other things, but she doesn't. She must realize that somehow didn't go as well as her team thought it would.
Well,
and of course, the result in Libya is a complete and utter catastrophe. So, I mean, rather than be something to be proud of, it's her greatest disgrace. And of course, the stupid Republicans, all they can do is talk about emails and Benghazi, and absolutely avoid blaming her for what is her real crime, which is incitement to the destruction of a country.
Well, we have Iraq destroyed. You mentioned before we have Libya destroyed. She was very proud to cast her vote for the war in Iraq, and both of these were on the neocon agenda, and. It's interesting, going back for a moment to Victoria Nuland, who for some reason the press calls her Hillary Rodham Clinton, but they don't call Victoria Nuland Victoria Nuland Kagan, because she's married to Robert Kagan, as you point out, who is the co-founder of the Project for a New American Century and a successor, the Foreign Policy Initiative, who is John McCain's foreign policy advisor, and will be, at the very least, Hillary Clinton's. He's anointed her. You talked to her. She's the War Party candidate.
Well, yes, that's what I've been saying. And you see, another thing that I stress at the end of this book is, you know, it isn't just a matter of individuals who is the president, because the president is there for a short time. The neocons are sort of permanently installed. And the president is there to be the best salesperson for the policies that the war party works out. And they thought, oh, we get a black man, or rather an Afro-American man, that'll make a good impression in the world. Now we get a woman, that'll make a good impression on the world. That'll make us look like we're progressive and so on. And of course, this is just fake. As a public relations stunt, because the United States is their one great talent is public relations and selling themselves. It's a commercial country, commercial from advertising point of view. And the great thing about Americans is they're trained to advertise, to sell themselves, to advertise. And the presidency is largely an advertising gimmick to fool people into thinking they're getting something that they're not getting. So the real problem is to change the whole background of the presidential show, which is largely an entertainment event, and change the basic policy-making crew, which now is horrible. It's financed by private interests in various think tanks. All of them get more right-wing than the other. And this is what really is making policy. And Hillary simply decided, because of her overwhelming personal ambition, to be the spokesperson for that particular power setup.
Well, it's interesting. The idea of a woman being president is going to change American policies. You go into your book and you look at the examples of other women leaders around the world. If you take away their sex and you don't know who, whether they're male or female, whatever, essentially it doesn't make a difference. When you're you have state power, there are certain rules of the game that you play by. And
plus the fact that there's a tendency these days, because of who they're working for women to show how tough they are and to be actually, try to be worse than the men. But of course, it's the same lot in all the cases. And I think it's pathetic that Hillary goes around trying to convince women that it will be good for them for her to be elected. I mean, that is pathetic. I mean, it's pathetic if anybody believes that.
My guest is Diana Johnson. We are talking about her new book published by Counterpunch Press called Queen of Chaos, about Hillary Clinton and the context in which she has functioned, which is U.S. imperial policy, which she has been at certain points a important cog, but nevertheless, the policy goes on with whoever is going to be in that office. One of the things that you begin the book in the introduction with a discussion of her role about the coup that wasn't a coup, that was a coup in Honduras. And perhaps a lot of people here forget that because we're supposed to forget it. We don't hear about Honduras in the news, except we read about gangs in Honduras and El Salvador and Guatemala, places where the U.S. has stoked the fire of gangs making those countries, the cities, unlivable. But perhaps you could kind of fill us in about Honduras.
Well, it was just the first instance of the fact that despite all these promises of change that came from Obama and so on, it's just the same old story. It's just like, go back to Guatemala and Arbenz. You had a reformist president, a reformist leader who wanted to do something to bring people out of dire poverty in a banana republic. And, of course, that's way back in the Cold War, and they overthrew him. That was on grounds of anti-communism. And in the case of Honduras, Hillary congratulates herself for finding a new excuse to do the same thing. No, it's not communism anymore since, unfortunately, the Soviet Union has collapsed. So we can't use that. So it's human rights. So as I say, she pours the old wine into new bottles. And now we overthrow governments. Of course, we don't really overthrow them. We just allow them to be overthrown by our friends whom we defend in Washington and so on. But now we overthrow them because of human rights. Well, the human rights in Honduras could not be worse since she overthrew the duly elected President Zelaya, who wanted to do some basic reforms in Honduras, which is the most backward of all the countries in the region.
And he was actually a very wealthy man who was accused of betraying his class.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, well, you wouldn't be a candidate in the first place if you weren't wealthy there, I suppose. But he had some sort of social conscience and wanted to to be a reformist. That can absolutely happen. And of course, then the oligarchy there trumped up false charges against him and got the military to overthrow him. And then Hillary's job was to put a gloss on this, to pretend it wasn't really a coup and that all we have to do is elect another president who was the one that Zelaya had defeated. In other words, to reverse the choice of the people. And then you say, oh, well, it's fine, it's democratic. So, you see, it's a very sneaky coup, and it's characteristic of her to be extremely hypocritical with what she's doing. And this is what she calls smart power. That means deception, basically, and bullying, and all the other things on the side of the military power which can come in as the final argument.
One of the things I found interesting, which I actually wasn't aware or didn't recall, and one of the important parts of the book is you put her activities in the context of U.S. global policy, making the point that it's not an individual that makes the decisions or changes the direction of the country, but to kind of clear the air and make sure that people don't think that she would do anything different. But you point out to this national security NSC 68 document, which was authored by Paul Nitze, which kind of launched the military-industrial complex, which determines more or less U.S. imperial policy. Perhaps you could tell us about that, because I'm sure most listeners aren't aware of that.
Well, they can find that out in my book, as I think
book,
I
yes.
did a pretty quick summary of it. Yeah, I mean, there's a continuity here. The point is that the U.S. came out as the most overwhelmingly rich, prosperous country thanks to World War II. So, I mean, there's an attitude in the United States that war is not such a bad thing, because actually, in World War II, the good war, as somebody said, we came out on top of the world, and the policy ever since has been to stay on top of the world, no matter what. And, of course, the military-industrial complex was invented, I say, by Nitze, and they always had to use a scare thing. So they created a huge scare about the Soviet Union, which in fact was exhausted from the war and simply wanted to reconstruct and was not the threat it was presented. And so when that collapsed, they have to find other threats. So they keep on finding threats, because the military-industrial complex has become the heart of the U.S. economy. There are all these contracts that congressmen can get for their districts from the Pentagon, and the nice thing about Pentagon contracts is that the Pentagon will pay you even if your product isn't any good, your planes don't fly, your helicopters fall down, no matter what, you get paid. So it's an ideal business for it's also, as Eisenhower originally had said, the military-industrial congressional complex, because the Congress people have a great stake in this, because they get contracts for their local businesses, or universities get contracts. And I mean, little businesses that make uniforms or something, it isn't all big planes and stuff. There's something in it, but of course, it's all at a deficit, because in fact, the government is paying for all this stuff, but it's really down the drain, and so the U.S. goes more and more into debt, but doesn't get called out for its debt because it controls the dollar, which is a world currency. So this is a tremendous racket that the U.S. is playing, and the politicians are just riding on top of this, expecting this totally unnatural situation to go on forever.
And the interesting thing is, in terms of, quote-unquote, the left, there has never been or has not been, that I recall, any kind of public mobilization against this whole defense spending. What an oxymoron that is. War spending. I mean, when it was the War Department until the 50s, and when the United States, about the same time as this document came out, they changed it from Defense Department to War Department to Defense Department.
No, they changed from War Department to Defense Department,
right.
Which is a marvelous example of lies, because it became less defense and totally war at the time they changed the name. But you know, the thing is that there's the left. Well, I don't know what is left of the left, to tell you the truth, and I'm not only speaking about.
The United States.
About the United States. This is true here in France, where I live. But you see, there's something ambiguous about Obama. For instance, he seems more reluctant than Hillary on all things. And unfortunately, his reluctance is being used by the Republicans and Hillary to make him look weak, so that his successor is likely to be even worse. And I say even because Obama has a record of killing people with drones. I mean, his record is terrible. But he does seem to be not so enthusiastic about all of these adventures as some others. But he has never had the courage to stand up and be educational, to try to enlighten the public. He had a perfect example of an opportunity for that when Netanyahu came and took over the Congress, so to speak. He could have stood up to the people and say, our policy should be made in the interests of the United States and not of a foreign country. He could be educational. That could probably wake people up, and it would cause great conflict in the country, but it might begin to make something move. But you see, he doesn't do that. He has simply been so quiet about what he, he probably does hate Netanyahu, but he won't say so. And the fact is that just by his successors look like they're going to be much worse, because he's given the impression of not being tough enough, when in fact he's been totally murderous, but it doesn't look that way.
That's why so many people still believe Obama really, underneath it all, he's a nice guy. But that's the image that the people who put him into politics wanted him to have, and he has that. He's the kind of guy you want to have a beer with.
Well, I don't know about nice or not nice, because when it comes to these politicians, I don't expect to make personal friends with any of them. I'm just looking at how their public behavior is. And nice guy or not nice guy with a beer, frankly, that is not the issue. The issue is that I think that he has had misgivings about these certain things. All of them who get up there are ambitious, and all of them have the malady of being too ambitious, of putting their personal ambition ahead of a whole lot of things. And in that way, they've also been vetted. All of the ones who get to the point of being a president have been vetted by all of the big interests in the country to make sure that there's somebody that can be more or less kept on the official line. And so anybody who gets in the job is likely to be pretty much like Obama, that is, who will, even if he's reluctant here or there, who will follow the line, who will do what he's supposed to do for one reason or another.
Well, I remember in 2004 in a Pittsburgh hotel room watching the Democratic convention and seeing Obama speak about post-racial America, and I was wondering, who was behind this guy? Who put him up to speak at this very important conference? I mean, a convention of the Democratic Party, and then I concluded that he had to be elected president because they knew in advance there was going to be a Wall Street bank bailout necessary, and that the Republican base hates the Wall Street as much as, even more than the Democratic base, that if McCain had been elected, he couldn't have gotten away with what Obama got away with. And then we had, of course, we had the Tea Party ready in a package, which would never have occurred had there been a McCain election. So it seems like this whole operation is like a managed game in which the public are spectators sitting in different sides of an auditorium having no input whatsoever, because whoever wins, the system wins.
Well, unfortunately, the population, I think this is very serious because I don't see where this can go. I think there, maybe in some distant past, there was some kind of popular input into American diplomacy. Maybe I'm being naive about that, but I think that one thing that's made things worse is the primary system. Because the primaries offer 50, or I think they're 50 states all have them, but I mean, they offer more opportunities for money to be spent. So the candidates have to have even more money behind them to run in these primaries. And also, all of these primaries and all of this focus is always on a personality and not on policy at all. And it used to be that the conventions way back when, the political conventions would get together and you'd have delegates from all over, and they might even argue about policy and programs and platforms and candidates at the convention and decide. And now there's none of that. It's all, there's a big show in one state after another, always requiring a lot of money. And so it's just who has, practically a matter of who has the most money, who wins. And the public has nothing to say about it. And this is very disturbing because I think there's a potential of opposition to these policies, but the system is totally blocked by this dreadful two-party system.
Well, or one party with two wings, the pacification
of course.
Wing, right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Of course, exactly. It's the money party with what I call the good cop, which is the Democrats, and the bad cop, which is the Republicans, and they're just but they're working for the same boss.
Well, it's interesting. I remember the 1952 convention with Tennessee Senator Estes Gifalver, who was a progressive guy, was going to get the nomination, and Jim Farley, who is a power broker of the Democratic Party, it was on television, and you saw him making hand gestures, and with his hand gestures, you had delegations changing their votes from Gifalver to Adlai Stevenson. It's very interesting to watch. That was the last time that kind of convention was shown on television. It's interesting that in the last Democratic convention, and the Democratic Party has always been very heavily reliant on wealthy liberal Jewish donors, and not so liberal, but mostly liberal, a plank was left out deliberately by the people running the plank that would talk about support for Israel. And on the floor of the convention, Antonio Villaraigosa, the mayor of Los Angeles, who was very pro-Israel, called for a vote when someone wanted to introduce the plank, to get that plank, pro-Israel plank, back in the convention. And he called for a vote from the floor. And each time he called for the vote, the nays overwhelmed the ayes. And the third time he said, well, the ayes have it. Everyone started booing. And that seemed to be the end of Villaraigosa's career because he pulled out of the race for governor. And the Democratic Party's base, the Republican, this is my opinion, the Republican Party has seen that the Democratic Party base is no longer buying this love for Israel business that has characterized the party, and this has moved the Republicans to seize or try and seize the moment. This is why Hillary writes this article, which I talked about before I called you, in the Jewish Weekly Forward and not in the New York Times, which is interesting.
Well, yes, but you see, she's definitely doing all she can to earn the money that she gets from Haim Saban. But you know, I want to mention something else. You know, our policy in the Middle East, of course, has been dictated largely for some time by Israel, but also by Saudi Arabia. And this is something I mentioned in my book, and I think it's becoming clearer and clearer that we are following what amounts to a Saudi-Israel line.
Right.
Because they have the same enemies, and they both provide a lot of money to the Clintons. You look at the donors, it's true that Haim Saban is so such a show-off that he's up there, you know, saying, I'll get her, I know, I'll spend all that's necessary to get Hillary elected president, because he's a big show-off, and he likes to show how rich and powerful he is. But meanwhile, the Saudis, have, I think they're the largest donors to the Clinton Fund. So she's got the money of both of them, and they're both doing the same thing, which is trying to overthrow Assad. So that, I mean, Israel, because he's more or less sort of pro-Palestinian, and the Saudis want to get rid of him because he had a secular regime, and they want to have a fanatic Islamists all over the place, like they are. And this is absolutely incredible that the United States is an instrument for the two worst elements. Of course, they're opposites, but they come together. And that's why I mentioned in my book this strange marriage between Huma Abedin and Anthony Weiner, because it sort of personifies what is close to the Clintons, Saudi Arabia and Israel.
Diana, describe who... We're talking about Anthony Weiner, the former congressman who had to resign, very pro-Israel, because he exposed his lower parts in an email or something, to a text message to a young lady. And Huma Rabin, I think she's she is Saudi, isn't she?
Well, actually, Pakistani-Saudi, but she grew up in Saudi Arabia. I think her father was Pakistani. And they're very, her family is a great big thing in international Saudi politics. It's extraordinary. And she was the closest aide to Hillary for years. And so really it's this extraordinary combination of Saudi Arabia and Israel. Of that combination, you can only expect more and more of the worst things you can imagine. And you've got them right now in this so-called, with Daesh, we can call it Daesh or Islam, whatever it is, all of these head choppers running over the cradle of civilization, which is being destroyed by American policy following the interests of Saudi Arabia and Israel. It's an incredibly insane situation.
And the human rights violations of Saudi Arabia, which trump in horror anything happening in Latin America or even in Africa, they think they've already beheaded maybe 100 people already this year. And thanks to the United States, a Saudi is now heading the UN Human Rights Commission. And there's never a word from the president or from Hillary Clinton about Saudi human rights violations. It's or Samantha Power, which we didn't get into
her. because they are our friends. And friends has a great big dollar sign on it. Because, of course, they will buy our surplus military equipment, which they can pass on to various fanatics. The situation is beyond satire, you know. I mean, it's incredible. And but, of course, we say, we say that France can't sell weapons to Russia. But, and they banned that sale, but they can sell it to all of the Islamic states. You know, that's fine. arm Saudi Arabia, arm Qatar or something. As if that's all right. You know, there are friends. Well, with friends like that, okay.
Well, that it really is something that you couldn't make up, because you couldn't find here is one country, Israel, that calls itself a light unto the nations, and we have the other one, the seed of these are this claim to represent the two great religions, and there's arguments about that, allied With gross human rights violations of different sorts, the Israelis aren't beheading people, but they've killed a lot of Palestinians and will again. And both of them are essential to certain degrees the United States, because the Saudis, of course, buy our weapons and keep our weapons industry profitable. I want to thank you, Diana. Any last word? Diana Johnson, the author of this new book, Queen of Chaos, about Hillary Clinton, American Foreign Policy by Counterpunch. Any last word before we have to go?
Well, I just hope you help people wake up to do something about this, because this is either going to end in total catastrophe unless somehow or other people wake up to stop it.
Well, Diana Johnson, thank you so much for being our guest today again on Takes on the World. It's a depressing report, but people have to know what's going on. You've helped to do that. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Good luck.
Take care. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.